From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Electronic dance music started in underground clubs in Detroit and Chicago in the late 80s. The trance-like repetitive beats got people up and dancing. It caught on. The Brits loved it. And it grew into a full-fledged movement. Raves, dancing, drugs, and the beat goes on, influencing all the music we hear now. This hour On Point, how electronic dance movement conquered America. You can join us on air or online. Is this your music? Your soundtrack? Were you at the raves back in the 90s? Is this the music on your playlist at the gym? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Los Angeles, California is Michelangelo Matos. He's a music critic who writes regularly for Rolling Stone, Red Bull Music Academy magazine, and NPR. He's author of the new book, The Underground is Massive: How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Michelangelo Matos, welcome.
Hi.
So how would you describe this electronic dance music? Is it identified by a particular sound or a particular kind of beat?
Well, it is identifiable by its... the name kind of tells you what it is. It is almost all made with electronic equipment as opposed to acoustic equipment or even electrified equipment,
so,
like an electric guitar.
I see. And over the years, there have been many terms to describe the music. House, techno, acid house, deep house, big beat, EDM. Why all the names? Differentiate.
Because they're all different things.
Okay.
House music, as we're hearing right now, is more disco-oriented. Techno is much more computer-oriented. The difference between those two is sort of the difference between disco and Kraftwerk. Kraftwerk is the main supplier of inspiration to the early techno artists from Detroit, whereas Chicago was the birthplace of house music, and that was a much more disco-oriented sound.
So talk a little bit more about how the music is actually made. What are the instruments? Who are the DJs? What's he doing? What's going on as we're listening?
Well, most of the instruments are boxes, or at least they were early on. They were drum machines and synthesizers. One very important piece of equipment that was being utilized early on, particularly in Chicago, was the TB-303, which is a bassline synthesizer that has a bunch of... it has five different knobs that control the pitch and the timbre and the decay. And essentially what happened with that instrument is that a group called Future, with a PH, put they were playing with it, and basically they had a bass line picked out. It's just a one-octave bass line – or I'm sorry, a one-octave keyboard. And you loop the bass lines. The idea behind that was to create something for guitarists to jam along with. But the way they did it was they completely creatively misused it and just kept tweaking the knobs and making the pitch go crazy.
Yeah.
That became the acid sound. So when dance music people talk about acid, that's what they mean.
I see. Let's listen to an excerpt from Strings of Life. This is by Derek May from Detroit. This is a classic anthem for the techno movement. So, Michelangelo Matos, tell us exactly where electronic music, dance music, was born. Where did it get its start?
Well, house music was born in Chicago, and it was actually the sort of result of DJs like Frankie Knuckles particularly, who spun at the Warehouse from 1977 to 82, and then from 83 to about 85, he played at a place called the Power Plant. And what he was doing was extending disco records a lot of times and looking for unusual records. This was after 1979, when the anti-disco backlash kind of hit its peak. There weren't as many dance records available. So what he would do is he would tape edit and extend the breaks, extend the tracks so that he could play all night, because he would play 12 hours at a time.
Mm.
And he also started playing a drum machine underneath the of records, which was something that a lot of Detroit DJs and Chicago DJs started doing. That sort of culty disco sound with drum machines and synthesizers became the foundation of the house sound. The techno sound was very similar, but it was mostly electronic. It wasn't quite as disco.
Hmm. And so you had these different sounds. Was it a different sound in a different city? One in Chicago, one in Detroit, then it moved to Los Angeles, and then ultimately over to London?
It actually moved to London before it moved to Los Angeles.
Okay.
What happened is in 1987, five English DJs, including Paul Oakenfold and Danny Rampling, went to the island of Ibiza and danced all night under the stars to this Argentinian expat named DJ Alfredo, who was playing to very large crowds in a big open-air club called, I believe it was called Amnesia, and he was playing all kinds of music. And the London DJs were mostly playing funk and soul. They were sort of playing classicist, older black music from America. And they were also, when they were in Ibiza, they took MDMA or ecstasy, and it opened their, you know, totally opened their minds, totally opened their ears to what you could do with this kind of American underground, very independently produced dance music. A lot of it was very cheaply done. Frankie Knuckles' first recording was done in the DJ booth of the power plant, not in a studio, for example. So when they went back to England, they were like, we got to bring this here. And Rampling began a night called Shoom in a fitness center in London, in a very déclassé part of London. And it only allowed about 500 people in. That was the capacity. And within 2 months, it was rammed. You couldn't get in.
Hmm.
And then Oakenfold started a club. Other people who were involved started clubs. And they kept going to bigger venues, but they couldn't get everybody in. There was just this mass craze for it. And within a year, you had these big, giant outdoor DJ parties in films and in film studios as well as outdoors. So it took about a year for it to become a mass phenomenon in the UK.
But,
and
so
then
that came
back to America.
Well, okay, but it was initially born in the US, right? It took the Brits
to
harness and commercialize the music. What were they hearing that Americans weren't, do you think?
It's a good question. I think they were – part of it was that they heard it through the lens of the MDMA. That became part and parcel of – how you experience this music in England, whereas in America, it was just for dancing. It wasn't necessarily a drug culture, except insofar as, you know, people who go out sometimes take drugs. But in England, it became this whole package and this whole sort of lifestyle. And that's what became the sort of the mode of it that got sold back to America, which led a lot of people to believe that this was English or European music as opposed to American music.
Mm. Let's listen to another track. Here's Call It Techno by Frankie Bones. He's from New York. He helped bring the rave culture to New York and America after an invitation to play at a rave in England.
Call it techno. You can feel the bass. Call it techno. Techno bass, bass. It started in Detroit.
So interesting to hear the story and what you write about in your book about mixtapes passed along literally hand to hand, right? From in this country across the pond to London, and boy, a movement was born.
And that was partly because in many cases the DJs wanted to, you know, they had exclusive copies of some of the records, like long before they came out. That's something that has held true over time as well. A lot of times DJs will have their own version of a track or just a track that they've made that no one else has, and that becomes their calling card.
How did you get into dance music? How are you interested in this?
I was hearing the late 80s pop stuff on the radio, like Black Box and D-Light, and really enjoying that, but also reading the British music press and starting to get the inkling of what rave was. And of course, not being there meant I wasn't quite understanding it, but around 92, you started to see more and more of this stuff, more reports of actual raves occurring in America, and of course that was very intriguing. And then in 92, it really exploded across America. That's where a lot of different scenes began. By 93, pretty much all of the U.S. scenes that were, you know, that would make an impact on the scene overall were well in place. But 92 was definitely the big year. There's a reason that there are more chapters in the book about 1992 than anything because – or than any other year because they were – you know, that was very much the flashpoint in America with the way that 1988 was in England.
You know, there are some people who say – and you write about this in your book – that this is really not music – per se. It's got a loud, pulsating beat. Sure, you can dance to it, but call it what it is. To that, you say what?
Well, people have been saying that about every kind of music at first. People said that about jazz at first. They said it about rock and roll. They've said it about just about everything. Hip-hop, certainly, they've said that about. This is not music. This is not what I'm expecting. And it also, it takes time for music to mature into its, you know, final form, or at least its, you know, mature form. And I think that definitely happened with dance music. The Detroit people were making pretty great records early on. It took the Chicago people just a little while, but it didn't take very long, I think. And it's very track oriented as opposed to, you know, song-oriented.
Electronic dance music. There it is. We'll go out with What is Love from the New York-based group Delight from their 1990 album World Click. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about electronic dance music this hour, its birth and rise to global popularity, and you can join the conversation. Do you like this music? Loathe it? Was this the soundtrack to your teen years? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Charlie is from the British electronic act The Prodigy from their 1991 debut album Experience. Like this song that we're hearing now, many top British dance hits of the time sampled kids' cartoons. I'm joined by Michelangelo Matos. He's a music critic and author of the new book, The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. Michelangelo, we've got a lot of listeners on the phone lines. Let's get one in here, Daniel from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to On Point.
Hi there, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I'm an ex-music critic, just recently retired, or forced out by a failing newspaper industry, actually.
Okay.
And I think that electronic dance music is basically the worst music yet.
Okay.
The 20th century created all these wonderful musics right from the start that the world loved, and now the 21st century is creating horrible junk that the world also loves.
So what is it about it that you just don't like? What is it in the music that you hear, Daniel?
Okay. It's unmusical to an extreme. It's not usually made by musicians.
It's made by DJs.
Stars are DJs. It doesn't have
Hallelujah.
All the virtues that pop music always had. It makes hip-hop and disco seem intelligent.
All right, punch back, Michelangelo.
Hip-hop and disco are intelligent, period. As far as electronic dance music, it is not unmusical. You really can't argue with something like that. It's a tautology. The guy has made his mind up.
But do you hear that a lot? Worst music yet?
Oh, of course I hear that a lot.
Is it an issue of getting used to this kind of a beat, this kind of sound?
Maybe it is more a matter of generational proclivity. I can understand that somebody who has come up on a completely different set of styles of music might not adapt to this, and that's understandable. But it always sounded great to me. It never sounded unmusical ever at any point to me, and I always heard it as pop music. I never heard it as anything else.
Daniel, thanks so much for the call. Here's Jessica in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to say I'm from Atlanta. I live in Atlanta, but I'm from Chicago originally. And I grew up with house music, and I was just very glad to hear the topic and glad that Chicago is getting the recognition that it really deserves as far as being a creator. You know, all of the DJs that were there, and when I was, you know, 15 years old in 1981, all we did was go to a club called The Playground, and all we did was go to the house, the warehouse, and it was just so much a fabric of my teenage life. And my 21-year-old college son, you know, who talks about EDM as it's something new, it's just hysterical to me. I said it's just house music. And guess what? I was there. So,
So Jessica, you don't agree with Daniel. Obviously, you love it. What is it about it? Is it part of is it the whole experience? It's not just the music. There's something else to it.
You know, it definitely is. And I can, from my 49-year-old aspect, self, no, I don't listen to EDM, but there are a few DJs that, you know, I say, oh, if my son is listening to it, I say, oh, I like that. You know, I see where he's coming from.
Who are some of those DJs?
Let's see. Who do I like? Dead Mouse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And let's see, who else? I can't think of names off the top of my head.
Sure, that's fair.
I'm not
Dead Mouse
really
is definitely one of the big ones.
Yeah, Dead Mouse, I like that. I like him, and I like what he was doing. But I think that it really speaks to teenagers, the 20-somethings, more so, just because it's not the same, as your previous caller said. It's the other, so to speak. And it speaks to a generation. And I think it also speaks to a culture and a sense of place. For Chicago, a gritty city, very much neighborhood-driven, you had that backdrop of the house music. And when it went, you know, when it dropped, you went across the pond to London, into England, I remember Farley, you know, all the different DJs. It's like, oh, they're going to London. Oh, cool, yeah, hey, they're in London. And it made me want to go to London, and I did eventually go to London. So, you know, music is very much a fabric of people's lives and very much a part of their generation and their history.
Jessica, thank you. It's a great call. And she brings up a great point, Michelangelo, the generational piece. Is it age-specific, would you say?
I don't think it's age-specific so much, but I do think that has a lot to do with it. I mean, it's a blanket statement to say that, you know, past a certain point you get it, and before that you don't, because there's obviously exceptions. But she also brought up Farley Jackmaster Funk, who had one of the first big – actually, the first big Chicago house hit in England with Love Can't Turn Around, which is an Isaac Hayes cover. And that was a big stepping stone in the music getting popular overseas. In England, they did hear it as pop music, and the early house records actually did – they were chart hits in a way that they just weren't in America. Mm.
Let's hear more EDM here. This is Go by Moby. So this was from 1990, Michelangelo. Moby was a dance artist, right?
Yeah, he was a DJ. He was also a musician. He'd been in punk bands, and he'd been playing guitar for different groups. But he was also a club DJ, and he started off playing new wave and things like that, and very much latched on to the Detroit and Chicago sounds. And that was true of a lot of DJs, particularly in New York, people who were playing in clubs. One thing that dance music definitely brought to the fore was the need to have, prior to house music, DJs in clubs didn't necessarily beat match everything. And house and techno made that an imperative for DJs.
Beat Moby, match? Is that what you said? Beat match?
That's right.
Yeah.
Putting the tracks together so seamlessly so that one flows into the other and there's no... you cannot always hear the join.
I see.
But Moby became one of the big iconic figures of the early U.S. scene. Go, the song we're listening to, was a top 10 hit in England in 1991, about a year after it came out originally. And that in itself made him a star in the States. And he had a very high-energy, punk-inspired live show. By the middle of the 90s, he was starting to move away from the scene and the scene from him. But in the first part of the decade, he was definitely the biggest U.S. star.
Mm. Yeah, I think I read the theme song. It samples the theme song from the TV show Twin Peaks, which was, of course, incredibly popular overseas.
He replayed it, didn't sample.
Okay, all right, great. Talk about raves, Michelangelo. What is a rave and why was that such an important, why is it such an important component of electronic dance music?
Well, that's where you hear the music in its natural habitat. That's where the DJs are playing the music to a dancing audience. And that's really where it works very well in that environment, in a dark warehouse or a dark club where it's just sort of you on the dance floor and the music. Very loud, very immersive, a lot of bass, a lot of feeling the music as well as hearing it.
And just everybody on the floor dancing, that sort of a thing. Describe the scene.
Oh, that's very much it. The ideal is that, everyone is on the floor. Everyone is sort of in their own headspace, but also with the group. And the DJ, it can be a little bit of a cliche that the DJ is a shaman leading the flock, but there's also a truth to it. A DJ's job is to really, read the floor and read the moment and play the right record at the right time. And at a good party, that's what happens. And often there's a dichotomy, too, between party and show. Mm. A show is what a band does. A party is what a DJ plays.
So in the U.S., EDM festivals or raves still draw hundreds of thousands of people a year. But I want to ask you about the name shift from rave to festival.
Yeah.
Why did that happen?
Well, in the early 2000s, the government... they were looking at numbers. MDMA was starting to really come into the country in force. There was a significant shift from 1997 when there were something like 400,000 capsules of MDMA or ecstasy seized, and 2000 where in the first 2 months alone it was closer to 2 million. Mm. So, this was starting to look like an epidemic, and the government cracked down. One of the chapters in the book is about New Orleans in 2000,
right.
This party that got raided by the DEA. And then in 2002, Joe Biden sponsored a bill called the RAVE Act, which stood for Reducing Americans' Vulnerability to Ecstasy. And that didn't pass, but a modified version of it was tacked onto the Amber Alert bill. Mm. And what happened is the venue owners were starting to be fined as well as the promoters. So it scared off the venue owners. A lot of people didn't want to throw the parties. And the music was starting to fade a little bit. It was moving away from the euphoric sound of the 90s. So it definitely reached an impasse in the mid-2000s. But particularly in LA and on the West Coast, the music stayed very popular. And also, the millennial generation came of age and had always heard the music as part of, the general fabric of pop in a way that earlier generations hadn't. So by 2006, when Daft Punk played Coachella, that's when the shift really happens. And the bigger promoters in LA particularly stopped calling them raves and started calling them music festivals,
right.
Basically, dance music festivals. Mm-hmm. So that's the linguistic shift that allowed the scene to continue.
Let's get another caller in here from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Storm is on the line. Hi, Storm. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I don't mean to sound jaded here, but
okay.
I think electronic dance music is sort of almost, it's kind of like the most watered-down music we've had in the sense that kind of like with the technology we have, everybody can take pictures with their iPhone and we produce more information, every day than all of humanity's ever produced before. Everybody has a laptop, you know, almost everybody, you know, has access to a computer, and they can, you know, if you have access to a computer, you can just download software and, you know, samples, there's free samples everywhere, and you can produce music. Anybody, you know, anybody in their, you know, everyone and their grandma knows what FL Studio is. Like, you know, it's a common thing. It's, you know, I bet 3 out of 10 households have that software in it, and, like, you know, kids, you know, growing up nowadays are just sitting in their rooms playing around.
What you're saying is it doesn't take a lot of talent, Storm. Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm not saying it doesn't take it doesn't take a lot of talent to produce bad stuff.
I see.
Back in the day, if you wanted to produce music, you needed to have access to a studio. You needed to have access to a lot of equipment, and you really needed to want to make that music. You needed to go get that record pressed. You needed to hand out that dub to the different DJs, you know, to get it played. You know, it was, you really had to work for it. Nowadays,
It's different. Storm, thank you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. All right, Michelangelo, here we go. Here's another one. You know, this is watered down music, something anybody can do.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And you say what?
Well, that's always been true. I mean, I understand what where he's coming from with regard to dub plates, which is the older fashioned. A dub plate is an acetate 12-inch, so a piece of vinyl that is pressed just once and is only playable a few dozen times. And that was a big thing for DJs because in the 90s, you could only play records. You could only play 12 inches, really. At parties, because you couldn't really DJ with cassettes. You reel-to-reels were too bulky and cumbersome, and compact discs were impossible to DJ with. That all changed in 2001, and what he's talking about, he mentioned FL Studio. That's Fruity Loops, and a lot of laptops come equipped with that. But in 2001, there was a big shift in the entire apparatus of DJing. Within 6 months, you had the Pioneer CDJ 1000, which allowed DJs to actually manipulate compact discs the way that they had with vinyl. And you had Final Scratch, which allowed you to do the same thing with digital files. And there was Ableton Live, which is now the standard laptop. It's a music-making piece of software, but it's also a lot of people use it to DJ. So it allows you to just DJ with a laptop. So yes, there is an enormous amount of people doing this and making music and remixing it, but and it means there's a lot of dross to go through for sure. But that I wouldn't necessarily say that the proportions are different. I would say that the volume is different.
Let me get another track in here from 1995. This is the Chemical Brothers. They're a British electronic music duo. They've won 4 Grammy Awards. Here it is. That was from their debut 1995 album, Exit Planet Dust. Michelangelo, talk about the numbers here. This is a $1 billion industry, which really speaks to its popularity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's rock and roll or hip hop or whatever the key musical style of a particular generation or even decade was. And it, you know, it was always big from the 90s on overseas. England and Germany, for sure. Paris, you know, there were all these scenes all around the world. But it took a long time to come to the States. And that's partly because of acts like the Chemical Brothers, who helped bring it to the rock audience.
We're talking to Michelangelo Matos, author of the new book, The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. Do you hear the beat in today's stars, listeners? We'd love to hear from you. You can join the conversation. Who's on your playlist? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We go out with the 1995 single, Da Funk, from the French duo Daft Punk. They always wear ornate robot-like helmets and gloves when they perform in public. Much more music in your calls after this break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, everyone. Tom here. The On Point podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. Here at the show, we interview many book authors, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, bestsellers or lesser-known but equally important titles. We love making you aware. Now, Audible.com is helping make books even more accessible, allowing you to listen to great titles whenever and wherever you want. They offer 180,000 titles, and right now, On Point listeners can get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. You can get started today.
We've come a long, long way together, through the hard times and the good. I have to...
This is Jane. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. I'm here for Tom Ashbrook today. We're talking about the news. I'm just... with the music here, Michelangelo, that's what's happening. We're talking about and listening to electronic dance music. You can join the conversation. Are you already tuned in to the next big underground music scene? What is the sound to your mind? Is EDM as lasting as jazz and rock and roll? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I got to say, this was the first piece of the hour that I actually recognized Michelangelo. I don't know what that says about me or my taste in music, but... I like this song. Michelangelo Matos is a music critic and author of the new book, The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. A lot of listeners in here. Amy says, I despise techno-electronic music. To me, it's simply noise with no talent at all. Mm-hmm. Kurt says, I turned 47 yesterday and love techno to pump my creativity at work and when being active. A lot of listeners. Here's Elliot in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Elliot. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Sure, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to talk a little bit about how encompassing a lot of dance music is. I mean, my parents are some of the more conservative people that, you know, they fit a lot of the southern stereotypes. But having introduced them to it, you know, there's a lot of music out there that they really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And having talked with my friends and everything else about it, we kind of decided from all the raves that we went to and all the music that we listened to that it's really a liberating genre of music. You know, when for our generation, when you get out of college, you have tons of student loans and, you know, lots of stress to try and get a job that isn't there. And when you listen to electronic music, you know, it's a very liberating feeling. You just concentrate on the beat and the movement of the song, and it kind of lets you forget your troubles. And I know after raves, we were all very, seemed like a lot of the stress in the world has kind of passed off once you go to a rave and you sweat it out on the dance floor along with, you know, 1,000 other people who are trying to do the same thing as you.
Elliot, thanks so much for the call there from Nashville. Michelangelo, you mentioned before the break the drug culture.
Yeah.
What happened in New Orleans, Joe Biden authoring the RAVE Act, reducing America's vulnerability to ecstasy. Talk about that, the fact that drugs played a really large part in driving this movement. Is that the dark side of this story?
Yeah, definitely. It can be. You know, it's very easy to overdo it, or at least it can be for people to overdo it. And that's definitely a danger, but it's also not that different from previous generations of music. You mentioned at the top whether or not this music would last or is lasting. I would have to say it's lasted. I mean, Frankie Knuckles really blueprinted the sound in the early 80s, so we're talking 30 years now. But the drug aspect was always there with jazz. It was always there with rock, particularly in the 60s. And that music has lasted really well, you know? And I think the same is true now.
Well, you say in the book that the irony is the people who invented this music back in Detroit in the early days were not really into the drug scene.
No. They were very anti-drug, in fact. When I spoke with Derek May, somebody I spoke with elsewhere had told me that the only time he ever saw Derek May on drugs was after he'd come back from the dentist on Percocet. And that's it. And Derek confirmed that. You know, they were very adamantly anti-drug. A lot of them were very sort of horrified about what was happening with the music in England and how tied to the drug culture it became because it was so different from their own viewpoint.
Here's Carl in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Carl. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hey, guys. This is Carl. Sorry, I'm just like really tied up right now. But
go ahead, you're on the air,
hold
Carl.
On 1 second. Could you hold on 1 second?
You know what? I'll put you on hold. We'll go to Will in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Will. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point. Hi.
Jane, I'm from Nashville, where surprisingly there's a lot of the EDM scene has gotten really big, particularly, I mean, with the artist Lauren Ashton, a.k.a. Bass Nectar, selling a Bridgestone Arena the past 4 years with this kind of omni-tempo maximalism sound. Doesn't really have a particular one genre. And I've been a promoter and photographer at many of these events, and I wanted to ask Michelangelo and you, Jane, particularly with, you know, dubstep initially being body beats and, you know, drum and bass, and a lot of what my generation has grown up with dubstep and where it's going now is trap. Where does Michelangelo and y'all see EDM or even electronic music, electronic sounds in general, being incorporated in music going to in the future?
Mm, good question. Thanks so much, Will.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's hard to say because the music does mutate a lot. It mutates pretty fast. And the last decade has seen a lot of action. You can definitely tell a record from 2015 as opposed to one from 2005. And so it makes it difficult. And there's also the fact that the technology that makes the music also changes constantly. And, of course, how we listen to it changes constantly too. But yeah, that's one of the exciting things about it. One of the exciting things is that it is always mutating and you are always sort of keeping up or trying to keep up. And yeah, sometimes it just falls back into more of a retro thing. And I think that's been happening a lot lately too. I've heard a lot of recent tracks that remind me a lot of older tracks, and that's very much on purpose. There's definitely a throwback feel to that. But that isn't so different from the rest of pop. You always hear a lot of throwback R&B tracks on R&B artists' records, for example, and in pop as well. So yeah, I mean, there's... He was asking about dubstep. That's been a very interesting trajectory because the very early dubstep sounded very little like the very popular dubstep that started to hit about 5 years later. And now and he alluded to dubstep sort of turning into trap. And what he means by that is a lot of people who were playing that sound sort of moved into this slower hip-hop oriented sound when dubstep sort of lost its juice creatively. And that's something that happens a lot too. A lot of DJs and producers will switch to a different genre once the one that they're sort of at home in starts to dry up a little bit. A lot of American dubstep DJs were drum and bass DJs at first, for example.
Let's get another track in here. Michelangelo Matos, you credit this live performance of Robot Rock, Oh Yeah, from Daft Punk at the Coachella Music and Arts Festival back in 2006 for actually bringing EDM back to the scene, making people realize it could be commercially successful. So was this a pivotal moment, Michelangelo, when the music industry finally realized that EDM was really viable? It was a viable commercial entity.
Yeah, definitely. It was at Coachella. Daft Punk had been on the wish list for the Coachella organizers since the beginning. And one of the funnier quotes in the book is Daft Punk's then booking agent, Jerry Gerard, told those guys one day, you know what my job is? It's to say no to people who want Daft Punk. Because they wouldn't do any live performances. They hadn't toured the States since 1997. When they made their second album in 2001, they just sat at home. They didn't even do DJ gigs. So it took a lot of coercing and a lot of money to get Daft Punk to play Coachella. And when they did, they came on late. Literally no one except their crew knew what they were going to do. And then they came out in this glowing spaceship and with this amazing LED light display. It was, you know, a totally galvanic moment where all the dance people were like, you know, this, it was a culmination for them. And for the people who were not necessarily into dance music but knew Daft Punk and liked Daft Punk, that was the watershed moment where they realized, oh, this is what everybody has been talking about. Mm. Now I get it. It's interactive, but you can, you know, it's for dancing, but you can just watch it too. It's a real show.
Here's a listener from our website who says, will this music stand the test of time? No. Does making this music require any advanced level of musicianship to produce? No. It does not fit the definition of music to me at all. Here's Tannen in Bloomington, Illinois. Tannen, hi. What do you think?
Hi, Jane. First of all, I want to say I saw Daft Punk in 2007. That was the greatest show I've ever seen.
But, you're here.
But Michael Adil, I want to say thanks for talking about the differences in kinds of electronic like dance music, where if you have Daft Punk, it's more production-heavy DJs, then you got like dance punk-type groups like LCD Sound System or like in Felix the House Cat, which is more traditional house from Chicago.
Right.
But thank you for, you know, saying that there are different things for everybody. But what I want to put out there is how positive dance music is, the scene, and how it brings people together. Like, that's why you see a lot of festivals and stuff like that with large amounts of people. And never before at different places, whether it be at a bar, at a party, at a festival, have I seen so many people so enthused about the music and about what it does, you know, dancing to it. You know, other shows, people might be interested in the other people around them, other things, but it's the only thing that I've ever seen that where the music is the focus.
Tannen, thank you. I'm so glad you called with that point. Here's Derek in Madison, Wisconsin with another idea. Derek, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I do a lot of technical and engineering work, and that compared to any other music of genre, like EDM really, like, allows me to focus. I'm able to like drown out office noise, and a lot of times because it doesn't have words, like it just keeps me focused. It helps me do work, and I use it as a tool a lot. And that, like, Modus Operandi by Fotech in college was the soundtrack to solving differential equations for me. So I just wanted to make that comment about it as a tool. So thanks for taking my call.
That says a lot, Derek. Thank you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Michelangelo, you talk in the book about how the electronic dance scene grew in tandem with the internet, of all things. How did this culture harness Silicon Valley technology?
Well, a lot of the people who were making the technology happen were ravers, particularly in the Bay Area. Brian Behlendorf, who wrote the Apache code that, you know, undergirds the entire modern-day internet, also founded the SF Raves mailing list, which was the first U.S. Dance music oriented mailing list. It was an email list, and he, you know, I used a lot of the archives that are still around on his Hyperreel or hyperreel.org. There's a lot of different regional scenes, and they each had their own mailing list, and there are a few with their with the archives still around. So I mined those for details on parties and things like that, and that was incredibly helpful. But yeah, like in San Francisco especially, you had a very connected sort of group of people who were putting on the parties and going to the parties and DJing the music and making the music. It's not that different to be a programmer and to make the music. A lot of programmers do make music or did make music, and there was that it was a very direct interface.
Here's Keith in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, Keith. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hey. I really love this music. This music has been impactful for my life and just people that I hung out with and everything else. I think it's great. I know we've had a lot of people that have said that they don't really like it or don't think it's music, but my big thing is that it's an invitation, and that well, few music even nowadays invites you into anything, and this one was an inviting. You get to go to a party, you get to feel the music, you get to be a part of it, and I just love it. I'd like to know if there's any up-and-comers that are even doing anything that are kind of like this. It's actually worth listening to. I've tried, and I'm not finding really anything that's new. But, I love this music.
All right, Keith, thank you.
Yeah, the way I discover a lot of it, especially now, is through DJ mixes. And that's an important thing, too. This is DJ music, and the optimal way to hear it is played by a DJ. sites like SoundCloud and Mixcloud have a lot of DJ sets on them, and I will often go on and try things out. It's often a matter of just typing in what I'm looking for, if I'm looking for a particular sound or even a particular DJ. And you can find all kinds of stuff online. To write the book, I listened to a lot of DJ mixes from over the years, and I not as much of that made it into the text, but I definitely, in the back of the book, I have something I call a mixography as opposed to a discography, where I list 10 recommended sets, some of them on CD, but most of them not, from that sort of speak to what's happening in the chapters. But yeah, it's DJ music first, and hearing a good DJ play it is really the best way to get into it.
Have more traditional pop stars or crossover stars incorporated this kind of music into their work? I'm looking here, Taylor Swift, mm-hmm. Britney Spears. Talk about that for just a minute here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at this point, it's almost impossible for pop and hip-hop in particular to be more influenced or more impacted by dance music than they already have been, because they've been mining it for a decade. Mm-hmm. So many of the big pop stars hired DJs, or rather electronic producers, to work on their albums. The last Kanye West album had a bunch of electronic producers. Beyonce uses them. Britney uses them. Just about everybody does. Black Eyed Peas grew big because they hired David Guetta, the French DJ and producer.
Do you have a favorite? Last word here, Michelangelo. Do you have a favorite EDM?
Favorite DJ? Right now, gosh, that's hard. I'm gonna say Robert Hood from Detroit is a big favorite, and he's been doing it for a long time, and he's always great.
Well, we're going to go out with the 2012 song Bangarang from popular EDM musician Skrillex, and with vocals by Syra. Bangarang won a Grammy in 2013 for Best Dance Recording. Michelangelo Matos was our guest this hour. He's a music critic, author of the new book, The Underground is Massive: How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. Thanks so much for bringing EDM to us today.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.